case is United States v. Hills. The party's ready. Okay, we'll hear from the appellant, please.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Heather Tragel, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, represent the appellant, Sergeant Kendall Hills. The military judge erred in allowing the panel to consider the charged offenses as propensity evidence to commit the charged offenses for two reasons. First, the military judge's misapplication of the Huddleston standard undermined Sergeant Hills' constitutionally provided presumption of innocence. And second, Military Rule of Evidence 413 was not intended to be used with one course of conduct with one victim. As to the first point, this case boils down to the notion that once the government takes an offense and decides to put it on a charge sheet and refer it to court-martial, that decision triggers substantial constitutional rights on the part of the accused. Thus, applying Military Rule of Evidence 413 in the same manner as it would to an uncharged offense should not be carried out in that way. The military judge here instructed the panel it could presume Sergeant Hills had a propensity to commit the charged offenses once they believed the offenses were proven by a preponderance of the evidence. This is a misapplication of the Huddleston standard, which is problematic when Sergeant Hills pled not guilty to the offenses and was constitutionally presumed innocent of those offenses. That constitutional presumption must remain until the offenses are proven beyond a reasonable doubt. While the military judge did instruct on the reasonable doubt standard, that did not alleviate the problem caused by the 413 instruction. Requiring a panel to apply two standards of proof to evidence of the same offense could inevitably lead to confusion and a potential erosion of the presumption of innocence. Here, the panel was instructed to consider the charged offenses under the preponderance standard to determine whether Sergeant Hills likely committed the offenses, then was instructed to consider the charged offenses under the reasonable doubt standard to determine whether he committed the offenses. Such mental gymnastics may or may not be within the panel's ability to perform, but it is not difficult to imagine that a panel member would be confused by such a set of instructions.
But they were instructed that they were to use the two different standards for the two different purposes.
Yes, Your Honor. They were instructed to apply two different standards to the same evidence, basically.
I want to go back to your argument about Huddleston. The standard there was whether or not there was sufficient evidence to support a finding by a jury that the conduct occurred. And is it your argument that the military judge erred when he analyzed, well, he didn't actually talk about Huddleston, but in his discussions, is it your argument that he made an error in reaching that plateau?
No, Your Honor. The military judge very well may have conducted the Huddleston standard, although it's not clear on the record in his analysis. My argument is that he actually passed that standard off to the panel when he instructed them to weigh the evidence under the preponderance standard. Now, it's important to note that neither Huddleston nor Wright, which adopted the Huddleston standard, actually held that the panel should be instructed on the preponderance standard. Instead, Huddleston found that it was proper that the judge make that determination before admitting evidence, and this court adopted that in Wright as a procedural safeguard that the military judge apply before admitting the evidence. This court has never ruled that the preponderance standard should actually be given to the panel to apply to the evidence.
Was the panel at any time instructed as to what the preponderance standard is?
More likely than not, Your Honor, is what it said. By a preponderance standard that you have to find more likely than not that the offenses occurred. Now, the Huddleston standard is supposed to be a gatekeeping function carried out by the judge. It is not supposed to be an actual standard of proof passed off to the panel to apply to charged conduct. Now, when used with uncharged conduct, this misapplication of the Huddleston standard does not present a constitutional issue. The conduct is uncharged, not subject to a presumption of innocence, nor subject to a burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The California Supreme Court addressed this very issue in Villatoro when, in that case, the court looked at the California rule of evidence, similar to that of 413, and found that it was permissible to use among charged offenses. However, it noted that when doing so, among charged offenses, modifying the instruction to remove that preponderance standard is necessary to prevent a potential erosion of the presumption of innocence or a lessening of the government's burden. Nothing in the legislative history of 413 evinces an intent on the part of Congress to subject juries to weighing evidence of sexual assault offenses under two different standards of proof. That is exactly what the panel was asked to do here. And in doing so, the panel instructions contradicted themselves at every turn. First, the panel instructed that they should weigh the evidence under the preponderance standard and determine whether he was likely to have committed the offenses, even if they didn't believe beyond a reasonable doubt. Then the judge instructed them, weigh it under the beyond a reasonable doubt standard to determine whether you think he committed the offenses. Then they were given a standard spillover instruction, that the only evidence before the court he could be convicted of, and that each offense must stand on its own. Then he contradicted that and said the sexual assault offenses, as they related to each other, could have a bearing on their deliberations. They could use that evidence for anything they deemed it relevant, and they could use it also to establish a propensity or a predisposition that Sergeant Hills had to engage in that conduct. The panel's instructions were contradictory and confusing at best. Now, while we as lawyers may be able to sift through the instructions and determine what the judge must have meant, as this court said in Curry, the panel members are not lawyers and cannot be expected to correctly
counsel
the law.
Let's shift to prejudice. Assuming this was error, how is he prejudiced? I don't think anybody argued predisposition in argument, propensity in argument. How is this prejudicial?
Yes, Your Honor. The government did not argue propensity in this case. However, the military judge specifically told the panel to weigh the evidence in this manner. So the instruction itself is what prejudiced him in undermining the presumption of innocence.
Well, the instruction is, I mean, but that's chicken and egg thing. The instruction, assuming the instruction was erroneous, assuming the instruction had the effect of confusing the members, how was that prejudicial? How did that prejudice the outcome? How did it change the outcome?
Your Honor, it prejudiced Sergeant Hills and changed the outcome because the military judges, through his instructions, inserted this erroneous preponderance standard that the panel...
Well, the standard isn't erroneous. Well, that's not... Your argument isn't that it's erroneous, is it? You're saying it's confusing. Well, the appellant's position, as I understand it, is that trying to get members to jockey these two standards and balance them is simply inherently confusing.
That is one part of the argument, Your Honor, that it does create a confusion. But the other part is that this preponderance standard in the instruction doesn't originate with actual case law. Huddleston never said that the panel should be given the preponderance standard.
Well, that's a different. Are you saying the preponderance standard, if applied to uncharged misconduct, is erroneous?
Potentially, Your Honor. No court has ever said that it should be weighed by the panel members. It's a gatekeeping function to be carried out by the judge.
Okay, that's your point. Your point is it shouldn't go to the members at all.
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, it's one thing to say it confuses the members, but it's another thing to say that the members' confusion therefore prejudiced the accused.
Well, Your Honor, here it's both. The preponderance standard should not have gone to the panel at all, and because it was done with charged conduct here,
that's what I thought your point was, the second point, that because it's charged conduct. Yeah, and then
yes,
you're jockeying with two standards and charged conduct.
Correct, and with the charged conduct comes the presumption of innocence and the burden of
proof beyond
a reasonable doubt. Here they were told they were basically allowed to presume something from the charge other than innocence before the presumption of innocence was negated at beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, his presumption only remained until the preponderance was reached, and then they were allowed to presume he had a propensity to commit that type of offense, based solely on the charged offense itself.
I think that's the thing that sort of makes my head hurt, right, which is, you know, the fact that they're basically told that because there's all these things on the charge sheet, then you can consider that as evidence that he did the things on the charge sheet.
Correct, Your Honor. That therein lies the problem with doing this with charged conduct. It becomes less of an exception to 404B, as this court stated in Wright, and more of an exception to the spillover instruction, which is in place to protect the presumption of innocence, basically.
Counsel, how does this work? Do you know how this would work in the members' deliberation room? I mean, I'm a high school graduate. I'm not sure I understand how this works when you're in there in the deliberation room. What is your view on how this works?
Your Honor, I could only guess as to how panels are actually using this, but my guess would be that a preponderance plus the propensity which is generated from that preponderance equals beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, I mean, when you're sitting in the deliberation room, maybe you've never been a member, but when you're sitting in there and they're talking about this, what are they, I mean, can they find, issue a vote on, say, finding him not guilty on the first offense, but if you kind of think he did it, then you can then use that on the next offense? And which offense do they begin with? Do you know? And maybe my questions are better served by putting them to the government counsel, but I'm just curious about
it. Your Honor, they're really, based on how they're instructed, they're not given too much guidance other than weigh it under this standard, create this propensity, and then use it among the charges. Where they start, I don't know. Potentially, they could start with one offense, not really find that it was proven, but they think he probably did it, create a propensity, and prove up the other offense, and then that offense creates a propensity that then comes back and proves up the first offense that didn't get proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
I'm lost already. I'll end my questioning here, but I think you're in the same boat I am.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
So here, there is a reasonable probability that the panel misunderstood the instructions in an unconstitutional manner.
They did acquit him of two of the three charges.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so I'm still wondering about prejudice.
Your Honor, they did acquit him of two charges. However, the evidence of the third charge, which they did convict, wasn't especially strong as well. In fact, the two charges they acquitted him of had DNA, and they didn't convict on that
one. Well, but the DNA was inconclusive, as I understand.
DNA, he was a match.
Well, I thought it was a match for... It was male DNA. Maybe I read it wrong. I understood it to him. The only thing they could figure out was that it was male DNA, but it didn't match. There wasn't enough there to match anybody.
Your Honor, it was the YSTR DNA, and it's the one that you can't actually pinpoint it down to a very high statistic, but it was, he couldn't be excluded.
Oh, that, okay.
So the government argued it very strongly in their case.
Fair enough.
Lastly, this court in Wright held that procedural safeguards were required to ensure the constitutionality of 413. However, when used with charged conduct, these procedural safeguards become a nullity. For example, the 403 balancing test, which has been found to be an essential safeguard, charged misconduct can never be excluded under 403 as the probative value of the charged conduct will always outweigh the prejudicial impact. Applying a test to already admissible evidence to determine whether it's admissible is going to result in the same answer every time. Thus, if this court finds that 413 can be used among the charged offenses, it should relook the procedural safeguards of Wright and craft a test that more accurately protects the accused when done with charged offenses.
Counsel, at the beginning of your argument, you were referring to concerns about one course of conduct with one victim. What test should we use to determine whether something is one course of conduct?
Well, Your Honor, that's really kind of a factual inquiry, which this court obviously doesn't engage in. But ACCA found that this was really one course of conduct.
What if the court below doesn't address that specific point? What do we do here in light of the fact that we don't look at factual sufficiency or find facts? How do we determine, or what do we do with the situation using your structure of focusing on one course of conduct?
Well, Your Honor, this court, unless it's clear from the charge itself that it's one course of conduct, I believe that this court would have to remand to the service court to conduct that inquiry and make a finding.
Does it matter, based on your argument, does it matter that it's one victim and one course of conduct, or would it just be a flat rule that you can't use conduct that they that is on the charge sheet to prove other conduct on the charge sheet as propensity to have committed the other offenses on the charge sheet, irrespective of whether it's the same victim or the same course of conduct.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It doesn't matter. That's really our fallback argument. If this court finds that it can be done among charged offenses, then we would argue that in this case it was improper to do so because it was one course of conduct. And that brings me to the second point of that it wasn't intended
to be. So you're saying that if conduct is charged, it can never be used in any circumstance as propensity evidence?
Your Honor, potentially it could be. I don't think that.
So you're not drawing that
line? I would not draw the line there that it could never be done. There may be a way to do it in a constitutional manner.
And we don't need to reach that point in your case, you're saying?
No, Your Honor. However, if this court wanted to address that, we would recommend how the California Supreme Court has handled it in modifying the instruction and telling the panel that it cannot generate a propensity from a charged offense prior to the government proving that offense beyond a reasonable doubt, taking out the preponderance standard and subjecting it all to just the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. But
counsel, does that satisfy all your concerns that you've raised here by using that approach?
It satisfies the constitutional concerns. Removes the contradiction and confusion from the instruction and also removes that preponderance standard, which has the potential to erode the presumption.
What does it do about the spillover instruction? You know, polar opposites, right? On the one hand, they're being told they can use it as propensity. On the other hand, they're being told not to spill over.
Right, Your Honor. It doesn't address spillover. However, appellant would be perfectly fine with this court, even finding
you're saying,
that it can never be done.
So you're saying we could decide your case with a very narrow rule, even if it doesn't address all of your greater concerns?
Yes, Your Honor. While that spillover concern would still be there, appellant does concede that 413 kind of allows that to happen, basically, with using offenses against each other. The problem is when it becomes charged and subject to a presumption of innocence. So if it is subject to a beyond a reasonable doubt before they can do that, then the harm is lessened and it becomes more like it was an uncharged offense, just on a charge sheet. Back to the one course of conduct, though, just to finish that argument. Propensity is defined as an often intense natural inclination or preference. So by its very definition, one course of conduct cannot establish a propensity, and it most certainly can't establish the propensity to have engaged in the conduct on that one occasion. And with the one victim, the legislative history makes clear that one purpose of the rule is to provide credibility to the victims in hard sexual assault cases to prove that often result in she said unresolvable swearing matches. Doing it with one victim, it allows the victim to bolster her own credibility simply because she makes multiple allegations and transforms the he said she said dilemma into a he said she said multiple times unresolvable swearing match. Thus, we would ask this court to find that 413 cannot be used among charged offenses, but if it does find that it can, that the preponderance standard must be removed. And if this court finds that that is fine, then this was not a proper 413 case. Pending any questions.
Thank you, counsel. Hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Captain Carling Dunham, and I, along with Captain Jihan Walker, represent the government in this matter. This court should affirm the findings for the following three reasons. One, the military judge did not abuse his discretion because he made the required threshold findings before admitting the evidence for MRA 413 purposes. Two, the plain language of MRA 413 does not differentiate between charged and uncharged misconduct. And three, even if the military judge erred, it was non-constitutional, harmless error, because propensity was not argued at any point during the trial, and instructions are viewed as a whole. In Wright, which involved charge misconduct, this court held that 413 is constitutional if the evidence meets certain threshold findings, that the accused is charged with an offense of sexual assault, that the evidence is of another sexual assault, and that it's logically relevant under MRA 401 and 402 and legally relevant under 403, and that the panel could find by a preponderance that the offense occurred. ACCA found as
fact. Counsel, in regard to that, when we're looking at whether it's logically relevant, how would the government define propensity? It's a foundational question, but how would you define propensity?
Yes, Your Honor. Merriam-Webster says propensity is a strong natural tendency to do something. So in this case...
So how can we, as compared to saying generally that someone who engages, let's say, in offensive sexual touching might also engage in a sexual assault, how in a situation like this does an allegation from a single victim in the same time frame with the same quantity of evidence in the same place, how does that indicate that this specific individual was more likely to engage in the conduct?
Your Honor, two things. ACCA found that this occurred potentially over a two-hour period, so it did
so
not
do you
happen.
Find that to be a meaningful distinction, though?
It cuts against the idea that this is part of the same course of conduct, that the appellant could have gone back to
but it was
in
the same room with the same victim and the same perpetrator, no one else was involved. So why should we draw a distinction there and say that it wasn't the same course of conduct?
Because the military judge also found that he couldn't indicate a clear timeline of events because the victim was going in and out of consciousness, but she specifically remembers being roused from consciousness on three different occasions. And for the first two penetrative acts, she was on her stomach. And for the third, she remembers on her back. So there was at least a moving of the victim such that it wasn't part of the same course of conduct in that two-hour time frame.
Well, ACCA found it was one course of conduct, didn't they?
ACCA said it could have been, but it also said that it was within, it could have been within 2 hours. So that would not be part of the same course of
conduct. The fact remains, as Judge Olson pointed out, it's two people in one place at one time. But leaving that aside, how do you answer the appellant's argument that throwing two different standards, one the constitutional standard beyond a reasonable doubt, and the other basically the tort standard, and telling them to figure this out on a basis of propensity to commit criminal acts, and say, oh, they can figure it out.
Your Honor, the Huddleston argument, for one, was not preserved at the lower court. That's new.
I'm not asking that.
Okay.
I'm asking how on earth are members supposed to figure this out?
Your Honor, members are presumed to follow the military judge's instructions.
And yeah, the judge instructed them on two different standards and gave them a spillover instruction and said, you can decide this guy's got a propensity by using the tort standard, but then you got to decide whether he did it by using beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that sounds confusing as hell to a bunch of lay people.
Your Honor, it may be confusing.
Well, if it's confusing, then can it be prejudicial?
Well, Your Honor, in this court in Schroeder looked at the DaCosta instruction, which became the bench book instruction, which is what was given in this case. And it said that either the DaCosta instruction is fine or the McCorse instruction is fine. And so based on Schroeder, the Army has continued using that.
Well, was Schroeder a case involving the use of only charged misconduct?
It had both charged and uncharged misconduct.
Okay, it had uncharged misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor, but in Schroeder, the military judge said that the charged misconduct for the daughter's rape could be used to show the indecent assault against the neighbor. So he specifically found that charged misconduct, you could use 413 evidence propensity.
Well, that's a little different. You got two different people there. That's a little different from this course of whatever you want to call it, conduct, which has one person, one location, and one time.
Yes, Your Honor. And as you mentioned, during appellant's argument, if you find that instruction to be error, although we give the military judge great deference where he's made a 403 balancing test on the record, if you find that to be error, it's non-constitutional, and there's no evidence that these instructions...
How is it non-constitutional if it suborns the presumption of innocence and the requirement that the government prove it beyond reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, it doesn't do so. Instructions are viewed as a whole, and in this case, during initial instructions, voir dire, and final instructions, the panel was instructed no fewer than 5 times that the government had to prove its case beyond reasonable doubt for each and every element.
Well, but that's that you're saying it's non-constitutional, and now you're saying, well, and besides, they were instructed many times. That's not an answer.
It's non-constitutional because it did not have a substantial influence on the findings. So this court in Solomon said...
Isn't that the whole problem? Well, you know, we talk about relevance in 413, but the real problem with this stuff is not that it's not relevant. The real problem is that it's way too relevant. It can totally undercut the presumption of innocence, and that's why we've got lots of technical rules of evidence to keep out relevant stuff, because it's too relevant, and that's the line you're treading here.
That's precisely the balance that Congress struck in enacting 413. Congress made that determination that in sexual assault cases, you need to put the evidence on equal footing. So while it can, propensity doesn't go to specific elements. It only shows it's a character determination.
Well, that, Counsel, that brings me to the question that I have in this somewhat confusing area. As you indicated, the members were instructed a number of times that the government has the burden of proving all of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, independent of any propensity evidence. Okay. That's the government's burden. Then what is the propensity evidence used for if it is not used to prove the elements beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, it is used to assess victims' credibility in their statements.
The victim's credibility?
It's used as a bolstering tactic for victims' credibility. The Tenth Circuit in NJD stated that it's 413 evidence and propensity is designed to shift the focus from victim-based to offender-based. So if you can bolster the victim's testimony, then you are placing more of a look on the...
Which is the government's burden.
But propensity, Your Honor, doesn't go to elements. It just goes to credibility.
Well, but now it seems, I mean, I know this has been, I know this is from the power of Congress to do, and I know it's been held to be constitutional, but you're skating awful close to the line here, aren't you? You're saying it's a statutory bolstering of something the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
So that if a victim makes more allegations, that victim automatically becomes more believable. Because a number of charges would bolster the initial offense's charge.
Not necessarily in every case, Your Honor. That's why it still has to go through the threshold inquiries and the procedural safeguards of the military judge's 403 balancing test. So in this case, when the military judge makes that 403 balancing test and it's detailed on the record, we afford him great deference. And in this case, he stated that every right factor weighed in favor of admission and used for propensity evidence.
That would, as the appellant's counsel pointed out, that would always be the case. I mean, propensity evidence, you know, as Judge Stuckey said, you know, is highly relevant, right? And so how is it ever gonna flip the balancing test? And you keep on talking about this as if it's a statute. I mean, it's a rule of evidence, right? What does Congress have to do with it?
Your Honor, when they passed 413 and 414 in the federal, and then it was incorporated into the military, we look at their intent in doing so. And so...
You're not suggesting it's a statute. I mean, you are suggesting it's a statute. I'm suggesting that you're wrong.
Yes, Your Honor, but in any event, the balance was struck was that we judge victims of sexual assault in a different way than we judge victims of other violent crimes. So 413...
Who is we?
Panels, Your Honor. Panels look at victims of sexual assault in a different way than other violent crimes.
You're basing this on what? And what does it have to do with the legal question before us?
That's what the Tenth Circuit said, Your Honor, and in JD was one of the reasons for why 413 and 414 were enacted. But in any event, we know that this did not have a substantial influence on the findings because the panel acquitted him of the two more serious penetrators.
But how do you know that? I mean, they might have acquitted him of everything, but for the fact that she made three different allegations.
Honor,
we don't know. I mean, and the argument that you're making, which is that it's to bolster the credibility of someone, is very problematic in the context of a case like this, for the reason that Judge Olson said. The more allegations that there are, you know, the more credible the person will seem. And you seem to think that that is weighs in favor of the government.
Your Honor, this court in Durell stated that since the members acquitted appellant of the rape charge, which was the more serious charge on the charge sheet, the court finds no reason to doubt that the members followed the instructions given them and did not apply the instructions in an impermissible way, and that's what the 413 instruction states as well, that they cannot use a propensity instruction to overcome a failure of proof in the government's case if they perceive any weakness. So the members believed that the government had not proven their case for the penetrative acts, and they did not use what they found, all the elements for the abuse of sexual contact, to somehow push them over the edge for the penetrative acts. They followed the military judge's instructions and found that the government hadn't proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt for the two penetrative acts.
Does the government have any objection to the defense's recommendation or suggestion that we adopt the California court's handling of this, that for unproven charged conduct that they are required to utilize the beyond a reasonable doubt standard when they are considering it for propensity?
Your Honor, that would be a departure from this court's precedent since you started analyzing 413 cases.
Well, we never had a case, though, where we've had unproven charged conduct used as propensity evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. In Schroeder, you had charged misconduct. And all the service courts recently in Barnes.
Yes, that's why we've never had to address it before, because we've never had such a plethora of use for this precise purpose, right? when that's the only thing that it's being used for, right?
Your Honor, this
court... Maybe we didn't need to address it before.
Yes, Your Honor, potentially, but in Barnes, this court declined to grant review, and that's the more traditional 413 case, and there were two victims.
Well, our declining to grant review has exactly the same value as the Supreme Court's denying certiorari. Zero.
Right. I agree, Your Honor. However, the more traditional 413 case was Barnes. I concede that the facts in this case are a little bit closer call, but this court can limit one of the right factors or provide more explanation of one of the right factors, and that would be the temporal proximity factor. Usually this court looks at temporal proximity and states that if the events are too far apart, that would weigh against a propensity determination. If this court finds that the military judge erred in giving that in the 403 balancing test, perhaps this court could talk about the temporal proximity factor if they're too close in time. So that would be within this court's precedent, but just an explanation of that right factor for temporal proximity.
Counsel, being mindful, of course, of the rules and precedent and circuit decisions and so forth, but just strictly from a common sense, real world perspective, can you explain to me why, if you've got the same victim during the same time frame, and I understand that you don't concede that it's one course of conduct, but I'm saying in the same time frame, same quantity and quality of evidence for each charge, just from a common sense viewpoint, why would an allegation from that one victim that a sexual assault occurred increase the likelihood, the propensity that individual would have engaged in another instance of sexual assault in that same time frame?
Yes, Your Honor. The Army Court stated that propensity evidence is low, and so any risk wouldn't have to be as high. Risk of...
Okay, but I'm not sure you're focusing quite on my question. What's the common sense approach of why that would show that the accused is more likely to have done these other offenses when it's all tied into one single case and one single incident?
Your Honor, because there is an indication in this context that it wasn't part of the same course of conduct. And so during that night, when the victim was intoxicated, he had a propensity to commit multiple sexual assaults on her in the course of that night. And that's why maybe the temporal proximity factor needs to be readdressed. But if it's error, it's more like the case in Solomon, in which the panel was given the 413 instruction, and this court stated that the military judge's 403 balancing test was in error. And in that case, the court held that the error was a non-constitutional standard. So we assessed prejudice, whether it had a substantial influence on the findings. The strength of the government's case, strength of the defense's case, and the materiality and quality of that evidence. In this case, the strength of the government's case for the abuse of sexual contact was the strongest evidence because it was the first time that the victim was able to affirmatively identify the appellant viewing his face. The other two times she was on her stomach, she only could see that her assailant was wearing white pants. So she woke up fully this third time for abuse of sexual contact, went to the restroom, saw appellant's face again, where he handed her a glass of water, and then she spent the rest of the night in the living room until she was able to be taken away from that house. Right. So the strength...
Captain Dunham, can I go back to, I think, Judge Olson's point about kind of the common sense approach to this? And you understand the problem I had with the appellant's counsel on how this works when you have regular folks back there in the deliberation room. How do you envision this working, given the instructions you had in this case? I know you may not have been a member either, but and we may never know how they do this. But and maybe they're doing it well. Maybe they're better off than me, and they know how to do this. But how do you envision this working when the members get back there after having received this interesting instruction?
I've never been a panel member either. However, there's no indication that they ever have to take a formal vote to get to that preponderance standard. It's their own conclusion. So they aren't taking a formal vote. And in this case, we know that they didn't apply that instruction in a way that they couldn't have done because they acquitted him of two charges. And what's the most important thing in this case is that propensity was never argued by the trial counsel. They never stated that appellant was a sexual predator.
Well, then why did the government ask for it to be admitted as 413 evidence?
Your Honor, I don't know why the trial counsel asked for that.
Inserted in the trial by the government.
Yes, Your Honor, but depending on how the evidence came out at trial, exigencies of proof, they argued this prior to in a motions hearing prior to trial, so they got the okay to give the instruction. However, they didn't use it. They didn't use it in their opening or their closing argument. So it wasn't confusing to the members that they had to use this propensity. In fact, since they also received standard spillover instruction, if anything, they were instructed more times to not use this evidence as
relevant. And that's not confusing?
It may be confusing, Your Honor, but we know that it wasn't prejudicial to the client, or to appellant, because they acquitted him.
Counsel, I understand your argument that this wasn't a single course of conduct. But let's just assume that it was. Let's take it completely out of this case and say that there was a single course of conduct. Should there be a different rule for a single course of conduct and propensity evidence?
Your Honor, perhaps, but it would only go to the temporal proximity factor in Wright. So if this court wants to state that if it's a single course of conduct, then that temporal proximity factor would weigh against admission and use to receive the 413 instruction. But the other right factors are still applicable, and the military judge still conducts a thorough analysis of those. I see I'm out of time.
You can finish your response, please.
Ultimately, with the presumption in favor of admission, the military judge has wide latitude to admit 413 evidence when he conducts a detailed 403 balancing test on the record, which he did in this case. The plain language of 413 doesn't differentiate between charged and uncharged misconduct. any error in this case is non-constitutional because propensity was never argued at any point during trial, and he was acquitted of the two more serious penetrative acts. Absent any additional questions, the government asks this court to affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. We have rebuttal.
Pending any further questions, the appellant would ask this court to dismiss the charge.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.